The internet, as we know it today, was, you know, more or less invented right here in the United States, but lately we've been slipping off of the cutting edge.
A recent test clocked the U.S. in 31st place when it came to connection speeds, and our next guest says that doesn't tell the whole story, with the new digital divide leaving poor and rural Americans with even worse access.
Susan Crawford joins us now. She's a visiting professor at the Harvard School of Law, a former special assistant to President Obama for science, technology, and innovation. Her new book came out last year, actually, is Captive Audience, the Telecom Industry, a Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. Susan, welcome to the show.
Oh, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks.
So we mentioned that test ranked the U.S. 31st in the world on internet speeds. Are we, in general, falling further and further behind when it comes to our connection speeds?
Yes, we are, and it's going to cause a major problem for the country on the global competitive landscape. Just take a step back here for a second. We're the only developed nation that historically relied on private companies to sell us communication services, and we did it under lots of public burdens to upgrade services, to, you know, sell things at reasonable prices. And as a result, our phone system was the envy of the world when it was introduced. So fast forward to today. Now, high-speed internet access is the substitute for basic phone service. You need it for everything you're going to do to be part of the global economy, and yet we've deregulated the entire sector. So these companies aren't evil. It's just not in their interest to do anything other than divide markets, systematically leave the poor behind, overcharge people in urban areas, and avoid capital expenditures on upgrading their networks. So we don't have a plan to upgrade to fiber across the country, and we're leaving a lot of Americans behind, which is going to just exacerbate and amplify and enmesh the existing inequalities that our country is suffering.
Let's get into that issue of unequal access. Who is being left out? Even the, you know, the average speed that's low in the world, a lot of us are falling behind that. Who isn't getting that speed?
Well, again, it's just rational, but for a private company to serve a rural area isn't necessarily in its interest, especially when it comes to running a wire out to that area, like a fiber optic wire. And so by and large, they don't. Verizon's Fios service is the only national available fiber optic connection, and that's only available in wealthy suburbs, essentially, on the coasts, and not available to the rest of the nation. So lots of people, either lower income people or people in rural areas, are stuck with either DSL, which is the new dial-up. It just is using your old copper phone lines to reach the internet, sometimes wireless, sometimes satellite. And these aren't substitutes for the world-class connection, which is fiber.
The rural connection is a big issue, an ongoing issue here in Wisconsin. Do you know how Wisconsin compares to the rest of the country, to the rest of the world?
Well, Wisconsin's pretty middling, and I want to tell you a story about a place I just went to yesterday in a rural area of Maine, Rockport, Maine. There, the town decided to build its own neutral fiber network, so a wholesale fiber network that connects to the big fiber optic link in Maine, the backbone there. And so the town isn't entering the private market. It just decided that it was a good idea to provide wholesale fiber that private internet access providers could ride on top of. They're going to see gigabit service for about $70 a month. And in Wisconsin right now, the best you can get, as far as I can tell, is about 20 times as slow as what that little tiny town in Maine is going to experience.
And that's one thing you've talked about in the past, municipalities, local governments getting into the game and providing their own infrastructure. But that's not even legal for cities to do in every state around the country. Is that right?
That's right. There are 20 states that either make it difficult or impossible to do it. And I have good news for you, which is that Wisconsin falls into the difficult category. It's definitely difficult. The cities have to hold public hearings in Wisconsin and conduct feasibility studies showing how expensive the network will be over 3 years before they can even start building a municipal network. And cities aren't allowed to subsidize those telecom services, and they have to charge minimum prices. It looks as if AT&T has enormous power in Wisconsin and was able to, for example, instruct the state legislature to mandate that the University of Wisconsin pay for AT&T services, double what they would have to pay to the nonprofit WiskNet there. So there are several little towns in Wisconsin that have built successful municipal fiber networks. Reedsburg is a good example, about 9,000 people. And in 1998, they built a fiber network for the schools in the city, and they've expanded to all the homes, and 60% of the people there are buying fiber. So they've got that gigabit service. Sheboygan County, the city of Sheboygan, is doing the same thing. Whitewater, Sun Prairie, I understand, is now thinking about it. So mayors and city councils all over Wisconsin are very interested in fixing this situation, and but they have to be very brave. They have to have all those public hearings, which can be very easily lobbied, and conduct these studies and also show that these networks are going to be expensive, and they are. This is just like building a railroad or building any piece of basic infrastructure. The upfront costs are high. The payoffs for society are extraordinary once they're in place.
Let's get into that payoff a little. I imagine some people might be listening thinking, all right, my cat videos download a little slower. I think of the internet as an entertainment system, as a luxury. Make the case that that's not the case anymore.
Yeah, not at all. So again, let me go back to Rockport, Maine. There's a media college there where the students are studying with the world-class photography and film artists. They need to be able to upload very large files to sell to clients. And there's a small business there that does nothing but provide web services. With the existing internet access service in that little town, they couldn't keep young people there because the uploading capacity, the ability to run a business from your home was just not present with the networks that they had. Everything is moving to the cloud. That means we all are going to have to swap around big files, including video of ourselves in meetings. The ability to enter a classroom requires a lot of capacity on your end. Let's say you want to provide very good telemedicine services. They're going to require fiber, too. All the talk about smart cities is going to need fiber for all the access points to make sure we're collecting all that information. So the internet is just the basic general-purpose network. It is the substitute for the phone. And just as we couldn't imagine the uses for electricity when it first came around, we're having some trouble imagining uses for fiber. But I assure you, Americans are inventive, and they will come up with those uses.
We're talking to Susan Crawford with Harvard Law School, looking at slow internet speeds here in the U.S. as compared to much of the rest of the developed world and unequal access within the United States as well. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. Do you have a fast connection available where you live, or do you have limited options, high prices? Are your kids able to get online and do their homework at home? Can you apply for a job at home? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue the conversation about the slow American internet. We've got law professor Susan Crawford with us. She's the author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age. You can join the conversation. What's the internet like where you are? What options do you have? What difference does it make in your life? 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go right to the phones now. We've got Adrian on the line in Trempealeau. Adrian, hi.
Hi. Just wanted to comment that I am looking for a house, and the availability of internet is one of the big things because I have the opportunity to work from home. But I don't have, there isn't enough accessibility for me to be able to do my job from home in most of the communities around where I live in the rural areas.
Adrian, thank you so much for sharing that story. Good luck with a house hunt, by the way. Susan, is that a story we're going to be hearing more and more over time?
Absolutely. We should be able to work where we live, not have to live where we work. But too many Americans just can't do that because they can't get a reliable connection. And this has lots of knock-on effects. It makes it difficult for rural areas to maintain their character. It makes it difficult for kids to be convinced to stay in communities where they grew up. And it ties people to driving long distances and getting on planes, all of which we know is bad for the planet. So, yes, we're going to be hearing more and more about the need for very high-capacity upload and download symmetrical connections. So that people can have the freedom to live in the most beautiful place they can.
And Trempealeau is a beautiful place. Good luck, Adrian. We've got Tim on the line in Osseo. Tim, hi.
Hi. I sell internet for a living as part of my job. but we sell it specifically to rural areas. Hmm. The problem that I see is not the speed, because we have three different services that I offer that give you 20 meg speed or better download. The issue that I see are data limits. It seems like everyone who wants to serve anywhere rural wants to put data caps on it. So if you want to be able to do any more than check your emails, you can do it very quickly, but you'll run out of data.
Tim, thank you so much for bringing that up. Is that another important piece of the puzzle, Susan?
Yeah, and it's crushing. I mean, in Stockholm or in Seoul, communications are unlimited, essentially. You never think about the cost of them. You get a gigabit connection for $30, and having that connection is just effortless because you never have to wait, you never have to worry, and you can start new businesses in anything from virtual reality to telemedicine. We're not even able to imagine that now. It's as if it's almost hard to explain what the difference is between what the reality should be for America and where we are now. It's like we're sipping through a very, very narrow straw when there should be an enormous culvert of information flowing into every house and flowing up from every house.
Tim, thanks again for bringing that up. We go to Madison now with Ben. Ben, hi.
Hi. Thanks, guys, for taking my call. I think earlier you maybe cited we're something like 31st worldwide. And I was just curious how population density relates to that. Obviously, we're quite a sprawling country. So if you'd maybe just comment on that aspect.
I was wondering about that, too. Is geography our enemy here? If we were a small, compact country, would that make lives easier?
No, there's no real correlation between the density of population and the Internet speeds. And again, it's not just speed. It's capacity and price. And when you look at all of these metrics, there are lots of countries where they have, you know, sparse populations. Let's take Sweden, for example. It's even more sparsely populated than the United States. But every little village, or more than 250 of them, has a dark fiber network that it owns and that it makes available to private providers. So they all take very high connectivity, cheap services for granted, just as the United States took its phone service for granted when it was first launched.
Ben, thanks for the call. Julie is on the line now in Milwaukee. Julie, hi.
Hi. My daughter just returned from a year in Southeast Asia, and my call is really actually a pretty good one, follow-up to the last comment. It wasn't about speed, but rather accessibility. She was in remote Indonesia, Nepal, Cambodia, Laos, Thailand, and there was never a problem with neither speed nor accessibility. She was in very remote villages, and they all had access to the fiber optics. The only she had a problem one time when monkeys in a remote area of Indonesia had eaten through the fiber optic.
Wow.
It's very sad. And having two kids, one at UW-Platteville and one at University of Minnesota, the Internet was better in rural remote areas of in Southeast Asia.
Julie, thanks for the call. Your reaction, Susan?
You know, we should be looking the rest of the world in the rearview mirror. And yet, for some reason, this issue has not risen to the top of the policy radar screen the same way that the electrification of America was the leading policy question in the 1930s presidential campaigns. The situations are exactly parallel. In the early days of electrification, 90% of farmers didn't have it at the time when rich people did in New York City. And so FDR just took on the special private interests that were controlling electricity and got it regulated, made it available to rural players. We don't, at the moment, seem to have the leadership and the attention to this issue that it deserves. I personally think this is the most important infrastructure issue the United States faces right now, and we're nowhere.
Well, you've talked about some local communities taking this issue on. What would it take to make it a priority at the federal level, at the national level?
Well, I think what's going to happen is that we're seeing more and more mayors getting fed up, and even big city mayors willing to take on the special interests of Comcast and Verizon in their cities. And gradually, it'll become embarrassing to the federal government not to set a very high standard for Internet access service in this country. But the cities are going to come first, because mayors are sovereigns in a way that maybe Mr. Obama doesn't see himself for this purpose, for communications services. And the National Conference of Mayors has already said this is an important issue for them. And so I'm quite hopeful that in the next few months, even, we'll see a lot of activity in cities to take on these problems.
Briefly, we've seen countries like South Korea make faster nationwide internet a priority as an economic priority. How fast do we fall behind if we don't start catching up?
We're already, I'd say, 5 to 7 years behind South Korea. But here's our advantage. We're much more entrepreneurial as a people than the Koreans, I think. They've grown up with these giant conglomerates like Samsung who just buy any new business. And so young people aren't as naturally ready to start new things as they are in the United States. So once we make the step to have fiber, I think the great new applications, uses of that fiber will come from the United States. Right now, though, we don't have that sandbox for people to develop new things. So I think we'll catch up quickly once we put this in, but right now we're pretty hopelessly behind.
Susan, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Susan Crawford, visiting professor at Harvard University's Law School. She's author of Captive Audience, The Telecom Industry and Monopoly Power in the New Gilded Age.
It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we'll talk with an Eau Claire author who's written the ultimate guide to a childhood classic, The Kitty Cocktail.
First, a new report out this week from the U.S. Conference of Mayors shows some good and bad economic news. The country has regained the 8.7 million jobs lost in the recession, but the average wage has dropped 23%. It also found that income inequality appears to have grown in more than 2 in 3 metropolitan areas between 2005 and 2012.
The report shines the spotlight on the growing wage gap in the United States. The mayors say they want answers. They say income inequality is a threat to American values. But where do you start when it comes to addressing that gap?
Joining us now to talk about some of the findings and how Wisconsin has been affected is Laura Dresser. She's the Associate Director at the Center on Wisconsin Strategy. Laura, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So a mixed bag here, yay on the jobs front, nay to the lower wages. What was your initial reaction to this report?
Well, you know, even the yay on the jobs front should be pretty tempered because there's a lot more people who live in the country today. The population has grown since 2008. And so just finally getting back to the 2008 level of employment actually means we're still behind. We're still missing 5 to 10 million jobs to make up for the population growth. So even there, you know, the news isn't great. But thank heavens we're finally back to 2008 levels at the national. So that is good news, or better news than not being there.
And yet the jobs are paying lower wages. What's happening there?
Well, the recession was a brutal one for manufacturing and construction. Those sectors have come back up a little bit and have nowhere near recovered their losses. Accommodation and food and retail trade, which are pretty low wage sectors, are the places that have generated the biggest gains in the recovery. And so what you have is a gap where we lost a lot of high wage jobs, an average wage, annual wage of $61,000 in the high wage jobs, the way the U.S. Conference of Mayors calculated it. And then the average wage in the case coming in, jobs coming in at about 47,000. So we're losing jobs that pay better. We're bringing in jobs that pay less money. And that is dragging down the economy as well.
Do you see that as a trend that's just going to keep on continuing, or do you see that turning around anytime?
Well, certainly as long as the labor market is as weak as it is, and I say weak because while we're at the 2008 level of employment, given the population change, it's still easier a labor market for an employer with a long line of people trying to come in the door than it is for an employee. So as long as that dynamic still is favoring the employer, it's hard to get much pressure on wages, especially when you have a structural shift moving construction and manufacturing out of the picture and moving retail and accommodation and food into the picture. So I would say looking forward, we've got to see a little bit more strength in the recovery and a shift back to the higher wage sectors, stronger growth from professional and technical, stronger growth from the healthcare and the educational sectors.
Now, income inequality was another topic in this report. What did it show about the country and about Wisconsin?
Well, the it looks very carefully, and I suggest the geeks in the audience go look at the data, because you can find every metropolitan area, 350 metropolitan areas in the nation. What it shows is that for two-thirds of those metropolitan areas, income inequality is higher at the end of the recession than it was before the recession, 2005 versus 2012. And they're measuring that in terms of the share of the population with very high income relative to the share with low, and that's growing apart. This is a long-term story in the U.S. economy, but it has and it was temporarily overturned as in 2008. Very wealthy people were hit hard by the financial losses. But ever since the recovery has begun, and even before that, this has been an inequality-producing recovery as well. And so we're just on a long, long march where economic growth generates returns at the top, stagnation at the bottom, and wage decline. A stagnation at the middle and wage decline for those at the bottom of the labor force.
But in terms of that trend, at least in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin seems to be looking a little better in terms of income inequality.
Yeah, it's interesting the diversity you can even see within the state. Fond du Lac does pretty well in terms of not generating a lot of inequality over this period. In fact, it's one of the cities that gets less unequal over the period. Madison and Milwaukee both are pretty unequal and increase, but you can see a lot of divergence. The picture of wage income distribution is very different in Madison and Milwaukee, but the trend ends up being sort of similar.
Well, as you see it, what are some of the societal impacts of long-term income inequality?
I think one of the things is that the rewards to general growth move more into fewer and fewer hands, it has a kind of corrosive effect on our public life and our public investments and our sense of a public good. The people with the greatest resources are more and more isolated. They tend to move more and more privately, whether that's private schools, private golf courses. They have the resources to move away from the public goods. And the income trends at the middle mean that the folks at the middle are seeing less money in the future than they see today, and so they're more concerned about taxes and other ways of that they feel like they don't control their money. And so you see a kind of simultaneous inequality undermining the democracy and undermining our joint investment in public things, I think.
Now, going back to the lower wages that we're seeing in these jobs that have been added, how does Wisconsin fare in that case?
Well, you know, accommodations and food, retail trade, these are the nation's low-wage sectors. The half or more of the workers in these jobs earn just at the minimum or just barely above it. Moving the minimum wage actually makes an enormous difference in retail trade and accommodation and food in terms of the income that that gets earned down there. So a lot of states have been experimenting with increasing minimum wages, some cities as well, where that's possible. And I think that makes a big difference in terms of the job quality for those jobs coming in. Still, they're still low-wage jobs. It's just a kind of higher floor that some states are beginning to establish. Wisconsin hasn't gone there yet.
And in terms of how Wisconsin, the trend for the future here, would you say that Wisconsin is well positioned in the coming years as compared to the rest of the country?
You know, Wisconsin is well positioned in some ways, though. I think Wisconsin has traditionally been a relatively low income inequality state. That is, and that's mostly because we have not had as many very super wealthy people here as other states have. And so, you know, we always tend to look like a more equal state rather than a less equal state. And as you said, you know, some cities actually got through this last 5 years and became more equal over the course of time. But the national economy and the Wisconsin economy are both becoming more unequal. Wisconsin's answer to inequality in some ways has been the quality of our manufacturing job base. But that has really, while it's, you know, more jobs than it was a few years ago, we're still 3 jobs for every 4 jobs that we had in manufacturing 15 years ago. That answer to inequality and middle-class mobility that we have had so long is just never going to be as strong as it was a generation ago. And that means that we need to find other sectors and other answers for a strong middle-class future for this state.
Now, in terms of bringing jobs back in the higher-wage sectors, what is it going to take for that to happen?
Well, that's a $64,000 a year question, right? I don't know the exact answer. I mean, you know, I think kind of economic development efforts that many people are trying, focused on higher wage jobs. Investment, though, I think, I mean, guess my answer is investment in the infrastructure that supports education and those industries, you know, the transportation and the broadband that supports the higher wage industries. And a strong, strong educational base that requires investment from kindergarten or pre-kindergarten clear through our four-year school system, our universities. That's what's going to build the workforce of the future. And that takes real money. It doesn't, and we're actually moving away from investing that in that as much.
We'll leave it there. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Dresser is the Associate Director at the Center on Wisconsin Strategy.
All right, let's all flash back to childhood now for a minute. You're out to dinner with your parents, maybe somewhere fancy, a supper club. What do you order to drink? A kiddie cocktail, of course, the combination of the bubbly soda, the grenadine, the maraschino cherry. Best thing ever, right?
Well, our next guest is no longer a kid, but he hasn't lost his love for his favorite childhood drink. In fact, he's pretty serious about it. In a new book that's a love letter to the classic cocktail, he lays out some new and unique twists on the drink, as well as some tips on how to enjoy it in style.
Stuart Sandler joins us now. He's an Eau Claire-based author and designer. His new book is called Kitty Cocktails. He joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Stuart, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you.
So
it's great to be here.
What is it about the Kitty Cocktail that's so special for you?
You know, honestly, it is such an amazing, magical little drink. If you think about back to childhood days, it immediately can take you back to those moments in life. And what's funny about it is how relevant it is to how it can bring you forward as well. And you can share those with other folks and younger folks as well.
And do you have that moment where you first encountered or at least remember encountering the Kitty cocktail?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I was about 10 years old. It was in 1984. We were out to dinner at a restaurant called the Dragon Palace. And the waiter was taking orders, and he suggested a Kitty cocktail. I wasn't sure. He suggested a Shirley Temple. I wasn't sure what he was referring to. And my dad just said, yeah, go, you'll like it. This was the first time I'd ever seen such a thing. And by the time it arrived, I wasn't exactly sure what to make of it. It had a little maraschino cherry with a yellow sword through it and a black straw. And the second I tasted it, I was just absolutely blown away. It wasn't like anything you could get from a soda fountain, and it was magical.
Well, now you're a grown-up. You still love these things. Where did you get the idea to pull together a whole book of these?
The idea I've had for almost over a decade now, I I'd been doing some bookstore shopping and had seen a lot of cocktail books, of alcoholic drinks, and I had seen ideas for mocktail books. And what sort of troubled me about some of the mocktail books is that they were pretending to be alcohol. You know, here's a version of a drink that's specifically intended to be an alcoholic drink without alcohol. And I thought there was this giant gap that was missing that was just primarily focused on the nostalgia, the flavor, the deliciousness, the sweetness of just a plain kitty cocktail drink. And I wanted to bring that to life and bring it back in a way that I thought was relevant.
Now, before we get to some of the specific recipes you've got here, let's talk gear. What sort of stuff should we have lying around if we want to be kitty cocktail connoisseurs?
Well, actually, most of what you need you already have in your house. Basically, you need a pitcher, a blender, measuring spoons, fun glassware because it makes the drink taste a little better if you've got the right glasses. A couple things you'll need to buy if you want. It's basically a cocktail shaker. Mm-hmm. You can either use a Boston or a cobbler shaker, which is a little technical, something called a Hawthorne strainer, which is going to work once you've shaken your drinks to pour them into the glassware.
Let's start with that basic Shirley Temple that got you hooked as a kid. What's the key to a good Shirley Temple?
You know, the key to a good Shirley Temple is really for two things. First of all, it's ice cold ginger ale. You want it to be as just as cold as it can be to keep that nice fizziness to it. Second thing is you don't want to overdose it with the grenadine. And the proportions are pretty important here because there is a gentle give and take between the ginger flavor and the ginger ale and the sweetness of the grenadine, which is a lot of people think grenadine is primarily cherry juice, but it's actually made from pomegranate. So basically, when you combine the ingredients and you put together the way that they kind of taste, that helps quite a bit to make sure that when you're stirring it, you don't overdo it. The other thing that's helpful is when you garnish it, they just put a little bit of an orange slice on it because the smell of the orange, in addition with the cherry and the ginger ale, it's just perfect.
It's a whole experience.
It is.
It's not just the ingredients.
Absolutely.
Well, you nailed my childhood with another one. I'm from Michigan, the Boston Cooler. Why is the Boston Cooler from Michigan? Do you know the answer to that?
I do, actually. The Boston Cooler was created by the Verner's Company originally to kind of help market their ginger ale product. I think one of the owners had an association with Boston Street, which was where the Verner's headquarters were located at the time. And so they invented the Boston Cooler because they were unable to compete with the Black Cow, also known as a root beer float to some.
And I grew up, I mean, they used to give us Verner's when we were sick as kids in Michigan. It was a tonic. And then, yeah, the Boston Cooler was a great float. What is it about the Verner's ginger ale? Or could we sub in other ginger ales if Verner's isn't available?
You could. It just wouldn't be a true Boston Cooler. Verner's, I found, is a sweeter ginger ale. The ginger is a little more subdued. My personal favorite is Canada Dry. I think that has the right bite and spiciness to it. And when you combine it with the ice cream, it's just perfect.
Well, I really, looking through here, this says something about me. I got hooked on a lot of the ice cream drinks and want to try them. Can I get your dispensation as a grown-up to drink these, by the way?
Of course.
Good.
Of course.
Well, the Elephant Charger. I don't know if you have the recipe off the top of your head, but that's a lot of fruit and a lot of ice cream blended. This is the one I'm probably most likely to try. Where did you come up with the Elephant Charger?
Well, the Elephant Charger actually is as we were going through the book and I was putting together dessert. This is in the dessert drink section. Mm-hmm. And I really wanted to find something that to kind of round it out, something that was more fruit-based. If you wanted to use real fruits, you could really punch up the flavor. As I was sort of doing my homework, and I found that I think the only banana recipe in the book as well, and it uses a nice overripe banana. But ideally, I wanted to kind of come up with some very tropical-sounding, very tropical-feeling drinks that had that sort of brought the adventure and the mystery of the Elephant Charger into your glass. So it's kind of an exciting one.
Now, there was some concern around here. Are we just rehearsing kids for a future of drinking alcoholic cocktails when we put out the kiddie cocktail?
Absolutely not. In fact, I think it does a couple different things. First of all, it gives us an opportunity to have a conversation with our children as we're preparing these things. We want them to know it's a special treat. It's something that we have like once a week or so. We want to have the opportunity to get in the kitchen. I mean, if you think about some of the things you like, kids love making putting their toppings on ice cream. Kitty cocktails is very much the same kind of concept. I love cooking. I know I love teaching my children about cooking and cooking with them, chocolate chip cookies, etc. But with kiddie cocktails, it basically creates a new forum to put the opportunity together where we can try different things and experiment. I think it's actually a little more closer to like mixology or chemistry. Mm-hmm. It gives that opportunity. And the other thing that's really important is, and this is in the epilogue of the book, is that we want to make sure that we're being responsible with our kiddie cocktail consumption because they are absolutely delicious cocktails. But we want to make sure that we're giving kids the opportunity to know, one's fine. They're always best with friends, and we only want to have them when it's a special treat.
So there's sometimes food in Sesame Street language.
Absolutely. That is absolutely it.
We have featured one on the Central Time Facebook page. You have some out-of-this-world type combos here. The Green Alien. Pretty straightforward to put together, this one.
Yeah, the Green Alien is a fun little drink, if you want to check out, it's certainly fun. It's a tangy one. This is in my it's called the custom creation section. So these are kind of emerging kitty cocktails that are basically popular, or I believe they'll be more popular in the coming years as opposed to the classic Shirley Temple. But it's a real sour, puckery, refreshing summer cocktail. And it's got a nice punch to it.
What's the next kitty cocktail you're planning to make, Stuart?
Actually, the Castaway is probably one of the tastier ones that I've found. That because when you're a kid and you have a kitty cocktail, you really gravitate towards the fruitier, the sweeter, the more sour. But as an adult, you like something more subdued. The Castaway is a nice combination of pineapple juice and orange juice, couple pinches of nutmeg, and cream of coconut. There's a popular ingredient called Coco Lopez, which is makes a real nice, thick, creamy finish. But it's just a wonderful tropical little drink.
Stuart, sounds delicious. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate the opportunity.
That's Stuart Sandler. He's an Eau Claire-based author. His new book is called Kitty Cocktails, and we have a difference of opinion here. Galen, the producer, says he doesn't like kitty cocktails, too sweet. Joe, the technical director, still drinks them, prefers them to soda.
I'm with Joe. Kitty cocktails are great.
I want to try some of these. They sound
Shirley
really
Temples.
Good.